Hello and welcome to the History of the Germans, episode 142, Adolf von Nassau, A Shadow of a King. And this is, by the way, also episode 5 of season 8, The Holy Roman Empire, 1250 to 1356. After the death of Rudolf of Habsburg, the electors chose another, now a truly impecunious count, Adolf von Nassau, to be king. They chose him over Rudolf's son Albrecht and over the overwhelmingly most powerful prince in the empire, King Wenceslas II of Bohemia. Now, this cultured and competent man became known to German history as a Schattenkönig, a shadow of a king, unable to wriggle out of his ties to the overbearing electors. Acting as a mercenary in the pay of King Edward of England and failing to create his own Hausmacht in Thuringia, many history books skip over his 6 years on the throne. Nevertheless, the events around his election and deposition form another crossroads in the history of the German lands that set the Holy Roman Empire further down the path to be neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. But before we start, I have a tip for you. If you are a fan of University Challenge, and quite frankly, who would listen to 140 episodes of obscure German history and isn't, tune in on April 8th at 8:30 GMT on BBC Two for the final. For those of you not based in the UK, University Challenge is a quiz show running since 1962 where university teams compete with each other. Many former contestants became leading intellectuals, actors, and politicians. The questions are such that most people feel incredibly smug if they get two or three right per show. Now, one of your fellow listeners, Justin Lee, is on the team of Imperial College. And my god, he and his team are smashing it. They're now in the final. And last week, Justin even got a question on Frederick II, which he obviously aced. The final will be epic, since their likely opponents are no slouches. So go tune in on BBC iPlayer on April 8th at 8:30 GMT. And if you're abroad, you can watch it through a VPN. And as always, I want to give special thanks to our patrons, Mike R., Carl S., Wayne D., Catherine E., Grant M., and Bobby K., who've kindly signed up on patreon.com/historyofthegermans. And now, back to the show. On July 14th, 1291, King Rudolf I of Habsburg went on his last journey to Speyer, the burial place of kings and emperors since the days of the great Salians, Conrad II and Henry III. And one would expect that once the magnificent gravestone was placed over the mortal remains of the man who had ruled the realm for 18 years, the immediate next step would be to call the electors to Frankfurt to choose a new king. But for months, nothing happens. Finally, in November 1291, 5 months after Rudolf's death, does the Archbishop of Mainz, as Arch-Chancellor in charge of elections, invite the other electors to an imperial diet in Frankfurt on May 2nd, 1292. So why did that take so long? Since the election of Henry the Fowler in 919, the imperial crown was formally an elective monarchy, though in practice, as long as there was a son, and that son was not a minor or obviously incompetent, the son had followed the father on the throne. And Rudolf von Habsburg had a son, Albrecht, the Duke of Austria. Albrecht was born in 1255, so he was already 36 years of age. He was a competent, though not particularly likable, ruler of an imperial principality. Plus, he had 12 children, more than enough to ensure the continuation of the dynasty. So, by tradition, the electors should choose Albrecht von Habsburg. But they did not. We talked last week about Rudolf's effort to ensure Albrecht's election during his lifetime, and the unwillingness of the electors to support his candidature. Once his father had died, Albrecht seemingly tried to gain support amongst the electors. Ludwig, who was Duke of Bavaria and Count Palatinate on the Rhine, was however the only elector he could bring over to his side. Attempts to get close to the Archbishop of Cologne seemingly went nowhere. We know practically nothing about the early stages of the negotiations, so it's hard to gauge whether Albrecht had made any advances to the other electors and whether they had any chance of success. The earliest documents date from the spring of 1292, when the discussion must have been going on for 6 months already. You get a glimpse of what the thinking of these guys was from the letter one of the electors, the Duke of Saxony, wrote to King Wenceslas of Bohemia. There he pledged his vote to whoever Wenceslas chose in exchange for 4,500 mark of silver, plus a guarantee for a payment of 800 mark of silver the king owed him, and support in a case he was fighting against the Archbishop of Magdeburg. But money wasn't everything. This was also about power. Last time, the electors had elevated a man of some standing, largely because the Pope insisted on having a functioning imperial ruler able to help shore up the sore remains of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. But in 1291, the city of Acre, the last outpost in the Holy Land itself, had fallen to the Muslims. That was not the end of the Crusades, but the Crusades that followed were odd attempts on the flanks of Muslim power or in the Baltics. The great project to take Jerusalem was over, and that meant the papacy had less interest in the empire than before, hence the electors were allowed to do as they pleased. And what pleased them was to assert the elective nature of the royal and imperial title by denying the son the father's crown. And this had become a lot easier thanks to the increasing formalization of the voting process. In the past, an ambitious candidate could get himself elected through tactical bribery and the intelligence scheduling that kept hostiles away from the electoral diet. Conrad III did that, and to a degree Frederick Barbarossa. We could even count Henry II amongst those that engineered their election by scheduling. In the late 13th century, these ruses no longer worked. A valid election required the vote of all seven electors, whether they were present at the diet or not. And thanks to Rudolf's insistence, these seven were now set. So even if Albrecht had rustled up two or three votes plus a smattering of minor lords and bishops, the election would not be as easily accepted as Conrad III's or Frederick Barbarossa's. In all likelihood, the other electors would then have elected their own man, bringing the realm into a civil war. So from this point forward, for the next roughly 100 plus years, the electors will consistently deny the succession from father to son. The crown will shift between major princely families, interspersed with the occasional poor count. Every time this happens, the incoming ruler will have to make far-reaching concessions, pay out massive bribes, and pass on more of the dwindling imperial possessions to the electors. And even that does not ensure the safety of the newly acquired status. Two of the upcoming 10 rulers will be deposed, one murdered, one killed in battle, and one of them considered so poor he was known as Ruprecht with the empty pocket. Now, this strengthening of the electoral nature of the empire stands in stark contrast to the hereditary monarchies in the rest of Europe at the time. West Francia, the kingdom that would ultimately become France, had started out as an elective monarchy and had remained at least formally elective until King Philip Augustus in the 12th century. But by the end of the 13th century, the French monarchy was not just in practice but also formally hereditary. Its king was given the epithet of Most Christian King and had achieved the status of sacred monarch, able to heal the sick purely by his touch. Hereditary kingship incentivizes the ruler to consolidate powers under the crown, rather than in the hands of his family. If a ruler can be sure that his son will become the next ruler, it's sensible to seize vacant fiefs for the crown and invest in a bureaucracy that supports a centralizing monarchy. If, on the other hand, a ruler can be sure that his son will not become king, as had been established at the election following the death of Rudolf von Habsburg, the incentive model shifts. Building up royal powers, as Rudolf had done with his revindication policy, did no longer make any sense. All the fruits of these efforts would go to someone else, most likely one of the king's rivals. And worse, the more powerful the role of king, the more likely the next king would go after his predecessor's recent gains. So, the rational move was to use the temporary position as ruler to expand the family fortunes so that the clan would be powerful enough to field the candidate in a later election and the whole game starts again. Historians of the 19th century have censored the electors for their decision to break the dynastic chain. Their actions, they claim, had condemned royal power to be hollowed out further and further, until the famous Voltaire quip about being neither holy nor Roman nor an empire had become a reality. But is that justified? Could we have expected the electors to choose Albrecht von Habsburg as king in 1292? Should they have given the Habsburgs the opportunity to build out royal power in the empire, first in Swabia and Franconia and then reaching out into Saxony and further north and east? Could they be expected to sacrifice their interests so that the Regnum Teutonicum could go down the same path as the French and the English kingdoms with just a 100 or 200 year delay? The French monarchy, which was in an equally dire situation in the mid-11th century, was allowed to build up its power base over time. What happened there was that the mighty dukes and counts surrounding the Île-de-France did not care much about the royal title, because it did not contain much actual power. And even if one of those mighty dukes or counts had developed an interest, they were so deeply disunited that they would have found it very difficult to agree on one amongst their own. So the Capetian kings were left alone, passing the crown from father to son and patiently building themselves up to the point where they could challenge and then take down the mighty dukes and lords, one by one. In the empire, that situation was different. Royal power, weak as it was not irrelevant, in particular in the areas that were close to the king, in Swabia and Franconia. But even in the north and in Italy, some of that old prestige of the emperors was still there. And as we have seen with Rudolf of Habsburg, the position could be leveraged to propel a family into the rank of imperial prince. So the electors cared about who was king. And, other than the French nobles in the 11th century, they weren't constantly at each other's throat. They did coordinate their voting behaviors, often forming voting blocks going into an election. So, the electors could choose to make someone a powerful ruler, which would be the best solution for the empire. But for each of them individually, that wasn't a great outcome. Unless one became the powerful monarch himself, the increased power of the king would come at the expense of their own position. Acting in one's own interest in this situation is what economists call a prisoner's dilemma, not a moral failing. And so we find that from now on the choice of a powerful ruler as king required special circumstances, be that war and other threats, coercion, lavish bribery, or firm commitments to respect the elector's rights, which in turn reduced royal power further. In 1292, there was no threat of war or otherwise, no coercion by the Pope, no overwhelming bribery, so the electors could avoid choosing Albrecht. This also explains why the electors did not choose Wenceslas II of Bohemia to become king in 1292. When his father Ottokar was already a hugely impressive ruler, his son Wenceslas II exceeded him. He gained his family the Polish and the Hungarian crowns, at least temporarily. It was under his rule that silver was found in Kutná Hora, adding even further to the wealth of Bohemia. We will no doubt hear more about him as we go along. Now I think it's at this point that I need to correct something I said in episode 140, that the King of Bohemia was a king in name only and that his title was purely honorific. Now some of our Czech listeners contested this notion and some quite vehemently. I guess as always, there are two perspectives on this. If you take the perspective of the emperors and the imperial princes, they did see the Bohemian crown as a vassal of the emperor. The rulers of Bohemia were originally only awarded the title to each king individually, and it wasn't until 1198/1212 that the title became hereditary. It was hence a title awarded to a vassal and as such could be removed in case the vassal broke his commitment. Not a theoretically eternal grant by the grace of God, like, for instance, the King of France. Now, if you look at it from the Czech perspective, the Bohemian ruler was his own master in his kingdom. No emperor could demand to come to Prague without being invited. Emperors did not exert influence in domestic affairs within Bohemia, and the King of Bohemia could not be summoned to imperial diets unless they happened near the Bohemian border. Hence, the kings of Bohemia may have regarded the vassalage relationship as a formality, worth accepting in exchange for the influence on the politics of its closest and largest neighbors. And they had used the term by the grace of God before. So, both of these perspectives are factually correct. Now, when I described the fallout from the Diet in Nuremberg in 1274, I focused probably a bit too much on the imperial perspective, to highlight the audacity of Ottokar when he claimed to be an independent king no longer bound by vassalage. I admit, I should have probably been a bit more nuanced on this, and I will try to do better next time. Now going back to Ottokar's son Wenceslas II, he not only amassed various crowns, but he also surpassed him in the world of diplomacy. As the election of Rudolf's successor was approaching, he had lined up two other electors, the Duke of Saxony and the Margrave of Brandenburg, to vote in a block with him. They did not yet agree on who to vote for, except that they would not be voting for Albrecht of Habsburg. What makes that particularly salient was that both Wenceslas and the Duke of Saxony were married to Albrecht's sisters, and the Margrave of Brandenburg's co-ruler was too. So, that puts Albrecht out of the game, but what about Wenceslas? He has three votes already, his own plus Saxony and Brandenburg. Historians argue that part of the arrangement between the three princes had been that Wenceslas could use their votes only to elect a third party, not to elect himself. There was then also the question whether the three archbishops could be convinced to vote for Wenceslas given his enormous wealth and power. In any event, there is no indication in the documents that Wenceslas at any point even contemplated putting himself up for election. Now, if we're taking stock, we have the Count Palatinate on the Rhine who's voting for Albrecht, and the other three secular electors are going to vote for whoever Wenceslas decides should be king, but not Albrecht. At which point it is in the hands of the three archbishops to select a new king. Mainz and Cologne take the lead and they choose someone broadly linked to both their families, Count Adolf von Nassau. Now Adolf von Nassau really was a poor count, unlike Rudolf of Habsburg, who had been a wealthy count. The county of Nassau had been divided and he was only the count of Nassau-Weilburg, which included the bustling metropolises of Weilburg and Idstein, all in the Taunus Mountains north of Frankfurt. Adolf wasn't only poor and from a comital family, so definitely second division if not regionals, which as far as the electors was concerned was great. He had also fought with the Archbishop of Cologne at the Battle of Worringen, we mentioned last week, so a loyal supporter of the bishops. But what qualified him beyond all other poor counts with loyalty to important churchmen was his willingness to sign practically any piece of paper any of the electors put to him. So Adolf promised the Archbishop of Cologne to pay him 25,000 mark of silver, return castles and towns lost during the War of the Limburg Succession, curse the city of Cologne to do penance before the Archbishop, never, never to let Cologne become a free imperial city, never to admit any of the Archbishop's enemies or their representatives to his council, etc., etc. Similar arrangements were signed with the Archbishop of Mainz, who was given two cities in Thuringia, the representatives of the King of Bohemia, who received the imperial lands around Eger and Pleissen, as well as the promise of a favourable decision should Wenceslas claim the return of Austria, Styria and Carinthia from the Habsburgs, and so on and so on and so on. The electors had their perfect king, tied down by treaties, all safeguarded by collateral. That meant he could barely go to the outhouse without a written permit from the Archbishop of Cologne. Now let's take a wild guess why Adolf von Nassau took the job and signed all these papers. Well, he had seen how Count Rudolf von Habsburg had raised his family to become imperial princes, and well, he wanted the same thing. So he began a two-pronged approach. On the one hand, he started a diplomatic dance aimed at getting himself out of these agreements he had signed at the start of his reign. And he was a cunning little count. He became very active in the areas a king was expected to deliver on, peace and justice. He travelled relentlessly around the parts of the kingdom accessible to him, and wherever he went, he heard cases as a judge and he renewed the Mainzer Landfrieden. His court attracted Minnesänger and many nobles out for a good time. And that gave him enough standing in the land to gradually slip out of the political ties to the archbishops. He entrusted the role of Vogt for the Lower Rhine to John of Brabant, the enemy of the Archbishop of Cologne, and he managed to marry his daughter to the new Count Palatinate on the Rhine, who he then tied to himself through various treaties. He reconciled with Albrecht von Habsburg, which meant disregarding the Bohemian king's demands for Austria. All that is great. but does not make one an imperial prince. The opportunity arose when the House of Wettin collapsed into one of its customary internecine feuds. If you want more detail, check out episode 107, The House of Wettin. But in broad brushes, the Landgraf Albrecht, called the Degenerate, had been at war with his entire family for a solid 25 years. He had fought his father, his sons had rejected his wife, who also happened to be the sole surviving legitimate child of Emperor Frederick II, and he chose to pass all his vast possessions, the Margraviate of Meissen, the Landgraviate of Thuringia, and the Land of Pleissen, to his illegitimate son. The wars that this policy engendered were vicious and destroyed the immensely wealthy Wettiner lands. When Albrecht the Degenerate was defeated by his sons, he fled to the court of King Adolf. Adolf treated him kindly and offered to buy his rights to the Wettiner inheritance. The price, a mere 12,000 marks of silver, was a ridiculously low sum given that these lands included the mines of Freiberg, one of Europe's richest sources of silver. The reason for the discount was that Albrecht the Degenerate was not in control of any of the lands he sold to Adolf, not of the Margraviate of Meissen, not of the Landgraviate of Thuringia, and not of the Pleissenland. They were held by his sons, Frederick the Bitten and Dietzmann. To gain his prize, Adolf invaded at the head of a royal army in 1294 and pushed Frederick and Dietzmann out. This could have been Adolf's great moment, the equivalent of Rudolf von Habsburg's battle at Dürnkrut. The Landgraviate and the Markgraviate were each imperial principalities and, though for the moment devastated, inherently incredibly rich. But it was not. There were a few problems. As I mentioned, Adolf wasn't a rich man. As king, he now had the revenue from the royal domain that Rudolf had so kindly assembled for him, but that was never enough to fund a military expedition into Thuringia. Nor could he count on the electors to support him in an endeavour that was exactly the kind of thing they had wanted to avoid with all their endless contracts. So the source of funds came from abroad. King Edward I of England had begun hostilities with France in alliance with Flanders and Burgundy. And he was looking for a diversion that would bind French forces whilst he attacked from the north. King Adolf von Nassau was to provide that diversion. There was an official treaty between Edward and Adolf that was all royal alliances and high politics, but underneath was a pretty simple deal. Money for swords. Adolf had no particular reason to attack France, certainly not in the middle of his Thuringian operation. But the money came in handy, and, well, he actually never attacked the French. It all stayed hush-hush until some clergymen found out and the Pope castigated him for acting, well, not like a king, but like a mere sellsword. Things weren't helped when it later surfaced that he had also taken money from the King of France as well, this time for not attacking. Now, meanwhile, in Thuringia, Adolf's policy began to ruffle feathers with the electors. Meissen and the Pleissenland were areas that Wenceslas of Bohemia regarded as part of his zone of influence. Like his father, he was not too keen on having a king of the Romans, now augmented to imperial prince, on his doorstep. And then the Archbishop of Mainz had important interest in Thuringia around his city of Erfurt. And he also got a bit miffed when Adolf replaced him as Landvogt of Thuringia with one of his supporters. Now, Adolf might have got away with all that had not several electors come together in 1297 for Wenceslaus' much-delayed coronation in Prague. This may have been where they first floated the idea, but by 1298 it went from mere chatter to serious talk about deposing the king. The Archbishop of Mainz invited Albrecht von Habsburg to voice some grievance he had against Adolf in front of the electors. Though this meeting in Frankfurt did not happen as such, a month later the Archbishop plus the Duke of Saxony and the Margraves of Brandenburg just happened to get together and open a case against King Adolf von Nassau. Mainz soon after received authorization from Cologne and Bohemia to act on their behalf, and even the Count Palatinate, the son-in-law of Adolf, joined in. Now once opened and the legitimacy of the court established, the result was a foregone conclusion. Adolf was convicted of breaking the peace, breach of the agreements made at his election, the extraction of funds from the church and, well, for good measure, desecration of the host. Upon conviction, Adolf was deposed and replaced with, drumroll, Albrecht von Habsburg. Because this time, an impecunious count was not an option. Adolf von Nassau was not going to lay down his crown without a fight, and he was in charge of an army. The electors needed to select someone who could lead forces against Adolf and win. And that man was Albrecht von Habsburg. Because Albrecht had already been fighting Adolf for some weeks by the time the electors had made their final decision. He had set off from Austria in early March 1298 and has been playing cat and mouse with Adolf's army, marching all across Swabia between Ulm and Breisach. In June, Albrecht decided to take his troops further north along the Rhine River, whilst Adolf followed him on the opposite shore. The whole game of marching here and there continued around Alzey and Worms, until news reached both camps that Adolf was now definitely deposed and Albrecht definitely elected the new king. That meant the electors could now officially get involved in the fighting, and with Mainz and Cologne not far, Adolf von Nassau needed a strike before support for his enemy arrived. On July 2, 1298, Albrecht lined his army up on top of a hill near the village of Göllheim. Adolf von Nassau, who came up from the north, had to attack uphill and facing into the sun. For Albrecht, the key was to hold out and inflict as much damage on his opponent as possible. He knew help would arrive sooner or later. Adolf, on the other hand, needed an immediate and comprehensive victory. So he fought ferociously, leading his troops from the front as any good medieval monarch should. Albrecht allegedly kept his cool on top of his little hill. And he was right to do so. The odds were stacked too far against Adolf von Nassau. In one of the rolling attacks, he was pushed off his horse. Heavily wounded, he got onto another steed, but he was unable to put his helmet back on. The sun was blinding him, and he was felled by one of Albrecht's men. Adolf von Nassau's body was taken to a nearby Cistercian monastery. Albrecht did not permit the dead king to be buried in Speyer Cathedral, as Adolf had requested. But Albrecht's successor, Henry VII, allowed that transfer, and that is where he still lies. One of his later descendants had his funerary monument remade in 1824, and it now shows him life-size praying in the vestibule of the cathedral. The counts of Nassau-Weilburg never became kings again. Their lands, much enlarged, later became a duchy with its centre in Wiesbaden. And in 1890 they became the Grand Dukes of Luxembourg, where they still rule to this day. The cousins of our King Adolf of Nassau rose even higher. One of them was William of Nassau-Dillenburg, born in 1533. As a child, William inherited vast estates in the Low Countries, as well as the Principality of Orange from a French cousin. And that principality was named not after the fruit, but after a lovely little town in Provence that features one of the best preserved Roman theatres in the world and is well worth a visit. William took on the name William of Orange, and became also known as William the Silent when he led the Dutch Protestant rebellion against the Spanish. The House of Orange still reigns over the Netherlands, and as a mark of respect, the Dutch national team play in an orange strip. But for our narrative, these great moments for the House of Nassau lie in the far future. Our preoccupation is now Albrecht von Habsburg, finally king 7 years after his father's death. We will find out how he gets on next time. I hope you will join us again. And do not forget to tune in on the BBC iPlayer on April 8th at 8:30 GMT for the final of University Challenge and watch Justin Lee do his thing.